Hello and welcome back to Millennial 2021. My apologies for the delay. There were technical problems. My computer is really acting up tonight. There's nothing I can do about it. I'm here now for the final stream of tonight, and this is with Stephen from Radical Liberation, a YouTube channel, and he's also on Odyssey. Should I address you as Radlib or Radical Liberation or Stephen?
It seems like when I'm on the internet in our, you know, our circles, people call me Radlib and I'm fine with that. So that'll work.
All right. So could you introduce yourself to the audience, please?
Yeah. So I have a lot of things to share and it'll probably just take the whole time we have to talk about those things.
I should just say beforehand that I have described you as a recovering libertarian. I don't know if that's accurate or not, whether you were a libertarian or whether you are recovering.
Well, actually, that was...
You can take it away.
I'll touch on that first. So I think some people have read into the name Radical Liberation more than they should. It might be interesting to folks to know that I chose the name Radical Liberation before I knew anything about libertarianism. So I actually chose that a long time ago. And it might be better to put the emphasis on the word radical.
I think I get your meaning.
Yeah. So, I chose the name originally coming from a spiritual point of view. The verse that comes to mind is, so if the sun sets you free, you will be free indeed. So, you know, when I was thinking about radical liberation, it didn't even have to do with politics originally.
Right. Okay.
So having said that, I did get more and more interested in what I'd call the, you know, classical liberal libertarian tradition, which I see as very old. When I think about this tradition, I don't think about the Libertarian Party, shall we say. I was never a leftist or what people call a modal libertarian or a Walbert. I'm actually a second generation right winger, I guess you could say. My dad campaigned for Barry Goldwater.
In the 60s.
Yeah, right.
Right, the late 60s.
He's passed now a couple years ago, but I didn't have a chance to ask him, but I remember him telling a story about him being at a meeting of a certain organization that starts with the same letter, acronym, or the its initials are the same letter three times. And I never did find out why he was at that meeting. But anyway, he just told it as a funny story because he had a lot of great funny stories. My father gave up politics for the ministry. And specifically, and I'll talk about this more later, he became a missionary to the Jews. He was trained by the fellow who went on, Moshe Rosen, who went on to found Jews for Jesus. So
Right. My
world growing up was in part what we call Messianic Jews, Jewish people who had come to believe in Jesus but retained their Jewish identity. So that is an interesting, I think, background to be in,
right,
to be talking to nationalists and so forth, you know?
Right. And so was your father Jewish?
No, my family's not Jewish. In fact, hopefully this isn't sucking up to you as a Scottish person, but the name Carson, near as I can tell, traces to Kirkcaldy.
Okay. Yes, it would be pronounced probably Carberry.
I'm sorry. Am I getting it wrong? I was told it was Kirkcaldy. Right. That's right in the south.
All right. Okay. I've not heard of it, but I will be.
Oh, you don't know? Yeah, yeah. It's way down there.
Kirkby.
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 Okay. Sorry.
Yeah.
Anyway, so Carson is a Scottish name, and then on my mother's side we have McFarlane back there somewhere. So I've got some Scottish in there. So anyway, yeah, I'm English and Scottish and that sort of thing by ancestry. No. My father was a missionary to the Jews. He wasn't himself Jewish.
So what does that mean, a missionary to the Jews?
Well, St. Paul was a missionary to the Jews, right? And then to the Gentiles.
Yeah, but I mean, this is something that is perhaps more familiar to American viewers than to British viewers, because, I think it would be fair to say that Jews are a more prominent part of American society at every level than they are in Britain. I think British people know very little about the Jews or Judaism, whereas I think Americans are just naturally more familiar with them. So could you describe what it means to be a missionary to the Jews?
Yeah, so it means that he, you know, Christian missionaries, you know, go to Africa and so on and so forth, right? He was a missionary to Jews.
Does that mean that he was trying to convert them to Christianity?
Yeah. Yes,
right,
exactly.
Okay. Right. All right, okay. So I wonder, because, you know, the phrasing could mean that he was serving them. Because, you know, there is the thing about American evangelist Christians who see, you know, themselves as subservient to the Jews.
Right, yeah. You could say that I grew up in Christian Zionism Central from that point of view in terms of, you know, reflexive support for Israel and so forth. And in fact, by the way, getting into libertarianism is one of the things that sort of red-pilled me on Israel, which was quite interesting for me, coming from my background.
Yeah, yeah, indeed.
Yeah, so, you know, I learned about the story of Israel and Palestine from the Journal of Libertarian Studies, very important paper in the 70s, where he showed how much of the land was owned right before, you know, the state of Israel became a thing, how much was owned by Jews and how much was not. And it's quite a shocking graphic if you've grown up on Zionist propaganda.
Oh, yeah, I think I can imagine it. The areas owned by, you know, by Jews has massively grown ever since, what was it, 1945?
1948 or something. Yeah,
1948. Right, right. Yeah, it's quite incredible.
So real quick, before I leave off on sort of the right-wing background, so to speak, I guess it's no surprise, given that background, that I was attracted to the Mises Institute, which has kind of been my ideological home for decades now, where, you know, they're known for their economics, but people who know them as, you know, libertarians or something don't realize how deep they are into revisionist history. They wouldn't know that, I first learned about the Southern Poverty Law Center because I heard that the Ludwig von Mises Institute was put on their hate map or whatever.
It's amazing how many people hear about the SPLC in the first place because it picks a fight with them.
Yeah, right, right. And in fact, I wanted to mention just a slight personal connection, but sort of one of the reasons that you are on my mental map is because I watched your speech about hope, not hate. And since I had that little bit of background on the SPLC, I was really pleased with your speech on hope, not hate, which I think it's fair to say, you know, don't want to be too prejudicial and throw everybody in a bucket, but it seems to me that Hope Not Hate, Anti-Defamation League, SPLC, Southern Poverty Law Center, they're of a breed, I
yes.
think.
Yes, for sure. I mean, I don't think it's as absolute as it is in the case of the SPLC and the ADL, but yes, undoubtedly there's a large tribal influence on Hope Not Hate. Yes,
well, they operate in a similar way, as I guess what I'm saying.
Oh yes, absolutely, yeah, they do. Yeah. I mean, yeah, they're
the smearing and the
their main function is to demonize people, to smear, to sabotage. They're a disgraceful organization.
Right, right. And if I can just take an opportunity to mention it, I think it's on Odyssey now, Rose, that your speech on Hope Not Hate.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes,
if you have not seen his speech on Hope Not Hate and you don't know much about Hope Not Hate, or you've just seen them being mean in the papers to your friends or something, I really recommend taking the time to watch his speech. It was really excellent, well researched. I think you had help on it, right?
It was a bit of a group effort. I mean, I wrote it, but other people helped me out with research and editing and filming. So that was quite a unique project because I tend to do everything myself. Mm-hmm. But with that, I decided to branch out and see what could be achieved by involving other people. And I think I'm really proud of the resulting video.
It's outstanding. It can help people understand who might think, you know, the only reason you wouldn't like, you know, Hope Not Hate or ADL or SPLC is like because you're a Nazi or something. You know, I think by the time you finish watching Woz's speech, you would be cured of any such thinking. You know,
I hope
they're,
so.
They're just terrible. They're just terrible, and they should be stopped. You know.
Yeah. Thank you for saying that, because that is what I mean. That was the purpose of the speech. It was to give people who might otherwise think that, you know, Hope Not Hate is quite an innocent and benign organization, an insight into how nasty and cruel and dishonest an organization it actually is.
Exactly.
That was the purpose, because they spend all their time demonizing and attacking other people. So I thought, well, they can have some of their own damn medicine back.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Except yours was probably a lot more fair to them than they are to us. You know?
I would say so, yeah. Their ability to twist things to create a certain impression is quite remarkable. But then again, that could also be said of journalists in general.
Right, right. Yeah, and they feed this stuff to the journalists, right? And the journalists basically just duplicate what ADL, SPLC, Hope Not Hate, they do their little reports, the journalists just echo it, and then Silicon Valley kicks us off everything, you know, that's how it works. But anyway, so other things about me, I'll do these real fast and then we'll come back to some things. So I have 8 children. A lot of people know that about me with my lovely wife. We had them fast. People think that it's the number of children. No, it's not. It's the velocity. It's the births per year rate. That's what makes it challenging. And we had 8 children in 11 years. So it was quite the journey, and we're still on it. Our youngest are 6-year-old twins, redheaded twins, by the way, speaking again to that Scottish ancestry, perhaps.
I've got to say, it's a very impressive achievement. You know, I congratulate you.
Yeah, thank you. Well, it's a joy and a blessing. I'm so glad about them. And that's part of the reason I mentioned that I have 8 children, is because I'm thrilled. I mean, I didn't know if I'd ever get married, you know, now here I am with 8 children. Anyway,
that's fantastic.
Another interesting thing is that I worked with Black children from the inner city in North St. Louis. I'm in the St. Louis area for 10 years through a ministry of my church. My mother worked with children from that sort of ghetto area for 24 years. So that's an interesting background. Furthermore, on the African-American front, I was the last student of a local blues jazz musician named Pops Porter. And his daughter, in fact, gave me his keyboard when he died. So that's kind of interesting.
That, I mean, obviously the arena of race relations is a massive one, especially in the American context. Is there anything, I mean, how would you say that shaped your worldview? Obviously, try to keep it fairly concise, but you can speak for as long as you want, really.
Yeah. Well, you've heard of Thomas Sowell, I'm sure.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Well, while I'm doing this ministry with these children and learning about their life experience in the North St. Louis, and, you know, the reason we were working in this neighborhood in particular is because I think it had the higher, that area had the highest murder rate in the city. So, you know, it was a place that clearly needed some help, you know?
Yeah. Just let me interject with a film reference, because people expect that off me and I don't want to let them down. I know that Escape from New York was filmed in East St. Louis. I don't know if there's any connection here in terms of their proximity, because there had been a huge fire 5 years before, I think in 1976, that devastated whole blocks of the city, East St. Louis. Mm. So it looked like a post-apocalyptic cityscape.
I did not know this. I did know that, not know that's where they filmed, but I'm glad you brought that up, because I can share a little story from that ministry. One of our pastors was teaching on Psalm 23, and he got to the part where it talks about the valley of the shadow of death. And he said, so what do you guys think the valley of the shadow of death means? And one of the young Black men from North St. Louis raised his hand and said, East St. Louis.
Wow.
So that gives you an idea. I was working in a rough area, and those people think East St. Louis is rough. So, you know, you can always go deeper. But anyway, I guess I would say that I was, at the same time as I was doing this ministry, I was also reading all this stuff like Thomas Sowell. And So that gave me some perspective on what I was learning through my students and their families and everything, what I was seeing. And then he was describing sort of how it got to be the way it was, you know. So I don't know what influence it had on me exactly, except to say that for me, political economy, which is sort of my area that I'm published in and that I do my show in, political economy is not a dry, lifeless thing. It's you know, these things that the state does, they have body counts, you know. They have people living in misery whose grandfathers and great-grandfathers were not living in misery. All of us now, but back then, you know, it was sort of more the ghetto, you know, that seemed to be really feeling the impacts of a lot of these things. So yeah, so when I think about these government programs that I view as having been at least part of the problem of what's going on in the inner city, I'm thinking about people I know. I have a goddaughter who's in the inner city. One of my students named my wife and I godparents to her. So, you know, to me, it's very human, all of this.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that's, it's not unusual, actually, for people who end up with certain views about things, views about race and so on, to have had personal experience. Well, you know, one of the cliches that you know, the likes of the SPLC will throw around is that only ignorant people with little experience of diversity are against diversity. Right. And where I think that's often the polar opposite of the truth, where it's people who have never experienced it that think it must be wonderful.
Right, right. Have sort of a fantasy. Yeah, Sowell talks about this sort of thing. It's, you know, we're being subjected to the fantasies of, you know, left wing social democrats or whatever.
And university students who right, think right. that all black people are like their black fellow student. On a humanities degree, when of course that is not what diversity means for the vast majority of people.
Right, right. Now, having said that, by the way, that was what I did then. In recent times, we've moved to an area that is basically where the St. Louis black middle class lives. Not exactly our street, but sort of our surrounding area is all the black middle class. And of course, as you might expect, they're quite different from, you know, the culture you hear about in rap songs. And it seems to me they're almost invisible. I'm sure in America, you hardly know that there's this massive black middle class who aren't going around shooting things up, you know.
I don't know. Maybe you listen to different rap music from what I do.
Actually, academic age, I rely on him on rap music. My last rap music was back in the before it was called rap, it was called hip hop.
Oh yes,
early '80s. Yeah. White Lines would be a song from that era.
Yes, anyway. Yes. Yeah, White Lines.
That's more my era.
Yeah, who did that? I've forgotten who did that song.
I don't know. All I remember is "Down in the Village." Though you might think it's silly, you can't tell the men from the women sometimes.
Yeah, yeah, I know this. I know the song. I know it quite well, but I can't remember who did it.
AA's screaming at us in the chat, I'm sure.
Yeah, so. Yeah, it's I know the one, and of course it's an amusing era. But anyway, that's another thing.
Yeah,
altogether.
Yeah. I was born in 1969, by the way, so I'm a little older than most people take me to be looking at me.
Yes. Okay. All right.
So, yeah. So I guess a couple other things. Tying into sort of moving towards the political stuff that we tend to talk about here. My research area actually is democide. That is the fancy academic term for mass murder by states. So it would include genocide, but also, you know, the commies killing the kulaks, right? That would be democide, even if it doesn't count as genocide for some reason. I don't know why it wouldn't. They were all basically Christian Ukrainians. But anyway, so I'm actually published I have an article in the peer-reviewed journal on that topic. And that remains I haven't been digging deep into it lately, but it remains a topic I plan to return to. And I spent a lot of time researching when I was young. I have one of our South African YouTuber friends has been asking me to come on and apply some of my analysis to their situation, because it's starting to look a little worrisome for the the Boers in South Africa, right?
Yes, indeed.
Yeah. So, and I'm concerned based on what I know, which isn't enough. Bringing us to the dissident right, I guess it's worth mentioning, and it's going to sound like I'm trying to big myself up, but there's a reason I'm bringing this up. I did predict 9/11, and I wouldn't have even remembered I did it, except that while it was happening, we're at the work cafeteria watching planes go into the towers, right? A coworker came by and leaned down and said, "You said something like this would happen." And because he said that, you remember 9/11. It's like, where were you when JFK was shot, right? It's that kind of day. I remember him saying that. And so I know that I actually more or less predicted it. And that sort of brings me here. I had a chapter one of my sort of political interests, which was writing for LouRockwell.com. Do you know about that?
Yes, and I actually have another person who wrote for LouRockwell.com is going to be appearing. I don't know how to pronounce her name.
Brittany.
Yes.
Yeah. Right. Brittany's appearing because she's my friend. We're all friends.
Oh, of course. Yes, she mentioned she knew you. Yes, I'd forgotten that.
That's right. She saw that I was doing it, and she thought she'd try to sign on. So thanks for having her. Okay. She's great.
Okay.
But anyway, my first sort of bout of being involved with politics was with the Mises Institute, with LouRockwell.com. I didn't write for antiwar.com, but considered myself a friend of Justin Raimondo's at Antiwar. I did write about against the invasion of Iraq and so forth at that time. You can find it's all still there on LouRockwell.com, articles by me and a few really good ones by my wife. And so how did I predict 9/11? And that'll bring me to sort of my second round.
That was going to be my first question. Yeah. How did you predict it?
Right. Well, again, maybe this is a US UK difference here, or US and outside of US, but Americans really don't know what's going on in the rest of the world generally. I defend my fellow Americans in this way. Having visited Europe several times, the scale is just so different. I mean, I remember going to London and seeing the city of London and learning that it was one square mile. And like everything you'd ever heard of is like in that one square mile, you know, Big Ben and Parliament. It's all in one square mile. And it's just mind-boggling for an American because we are on such a vast scale.
Yes.
I drive to Chicago. It's about 4.5 to 5 hours every year to bring my 8-year-old to visit my best friend and his 8-year-old. And every year they come and they visit me. And this is, to us, this is like driving down the street, right? In England, you drive 5 hours and it's like you're going across the Sahara or something, right?
Yes.
Let
me just say this, because I think this actually came, did this come up in a previous millennial? I was saying to someone the other day, it was a private thing. Yeah, I was saying to someone the other day that it's easy for people in Britain and elsewhere to castigate Americans for not knowing about the rest of the world. But in truth, America is a massive world unto itself. It's a very complex, very complex beast. Thousands of different pockets, thousands of different bits within it that one could know about or hear about.
Yep.
And, you know, cities, states, forests, deserts, rivers, mountain ranges, towns. So, you know, universities, all of these different things that people could have heard of they'll know somebody who's going there the next year. They'll know someone who was there 5 years ago. They might go there this year. And you know, this is America is huge.
Yeah.
And it has all these different climates and all different terrains. So it's actually quite a lot to ask of someone to know about all of that and to know about the rest of the world as well.
You got me. Exactly. Right. Yeah. So I was born in South Florida. I was born outside of Miami, and I regularly went to visit my grandparents and my cousins, drove there. It's, I think, 17-hour drive. Now, if you drive for 17 hours on the continent, I mean, where would this get you? From Belgium to Italy, to the bottom of Italy? I don't know. You'd cover a lot of territory, right? Yeah. Just to give you the idea of scale. So, I I sort of defend my fellow Americans in that regard. Having said that, because of my interest in anti-imperialism, you know, the anti-war, libertarian anti-war stance, antiwar.com, lewrockwell.com, I knew what the U.S. empire was up to. And so what happened was I was actually feeling something because I was reading about what was happening, the sanctions on Iraq, for example, that were happening prior to 9/11. And Madeleine Albright saying that 500,000 children dying from the sanctions was worth it.
Yes.
That's something that Americans, many Americans didn't even know she said that. But my understanding is that her words rang through the Muslim world, or the Arab world at least. And you can imagine how that made people feel. So I was aware of what was happening. And so that's how I essentially predicted 9/11, is I could just feel the anger rising. And I could feel it. In fact, by the way, I wasn't the only one. A good friend of mine was actually working in the financial district in Manhattan, the very place where 9/11 happened. He felt something coming too, and moved to Australia before 9/11. He had been there earlier in 2001, I think. So, you know, I wasn't the only one who could see it coming. So anyway, I say all that to explain sort of chapter two for me, which is that, you know, we had all these children very fast. I kind of dropped away from being involved in politics and stuff because we were just having baby after baby. And then just a couple years ago, we started to get a little sip of air above the water. You know, we're not above the water yet, but we're starting to get breaths, you know, from just dealing with babies all the time. And I thought about getting involved and engaged in political stuff again. And I thought, you know, I think I might give this YouTube thing a try. I really like the community I see. This is going back a couple of years before everyone got kicked off, right?
Yeah, I was just thinking like a lamb to the slaughter, you know?
Yeah, exactly. But you know, I really liked that people were talking to each other, at least back then, right? Across sort of labels and political divides.
Oh, I thought it was that wonderful. It was great. It was great fun.
Yeah, it was healthy, it seemed to me. There was healthy dialogue going on.
And
maybe
also,
that's why they stopped it.
yeah. I think it's exactly the case. I think there was a nice sense that we can talk without the like without the teacher listening in and telling us what we should be saying to each other and how we should feel about each other.
And who should talk to who?
Exactly.
You didn't feel like these artificial barriers of, oh, I'm not allowed to talk to them because they're not, I'm right and they're left or whatever it is, you know.
Exactly. Yeah. And one of the most bizarre episodes in my YouTube career was a stream that I did with an Antifa professor, Mike Isaacson, which was, I mean, we didn't agree on anything. We didn't find any common ground. But it was very strange indeed. Very interesting.
Yeah, but you talked.
Yeah.
Right. So anyway, I decided to get back into the game and try a YouTube channel. And with the help of Academic Agent, who's been a real friend to me, I was able to, you know, start to build an audience and everything. And so I'm sort of working on that now. Radical Liberation on YouTube. Check it out.
That was how I discovered you in the first place. It was from your appearances on his streams.
Right. But I was feeling something again, like I did before 9/11. You know, I mentioned that rising anger I felt. And this time, though, I was feeling it from, I guess we'd call it the dissident right. And so
what was that anger generated by?
Well, I didn't know. That's part of the reason I just started paying attention, you know.
Right, okay.
Listening to Morgoth and et cetera, you know, who I feel like I've become friends with by now. But you know, trying to hear what people were concerned about. And I learned some things, right? I didn't know anything about the whole grooming gang mess.
Americans don't. I remember trying to tell an American about it on Facebook when it came out, you know, back in late 2014. And he simply wouldn't believe me. Because I even showed him news articles. He said, oh, no, this must be exaggerated. It can't be real. This is going to be shock stories. It's just too outrageous. It's too ridiculous. No society would allow this to happen. No government, no police force. You're telling me racist horror stories.
Right.
I just wouldn't believe it because it is so incredible and awful.
I know. Yeah, and I have a problem with people using language in weaselly ways, you know, like the U.S. military talks about collateral damage, right?
Yes.
When they've slaughtered an innocent family, you know? So I have trouble with that term grooming gang. So I even as I bring up the term, it makes me wince. I prefer mass ethnic rape, which is sort of a pretty blunt way to put it, but I think it's accurate.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah. I absolutely say that. I mean, if we're talking about the mass rape grooming of white girls by Pakistani Muslims, then of course there's an ethnic dimension to that.
Right.
Whether it's intended or not, whether it's conscious or not, although of course it is, because how could you not be conscious?
Well, we've heard the testimony from the young ladies saying what was said to them.
Right. Yes, exactly. So, of course, it's an ethnic. And this is one thing that I always struggled with white people, British people. They would say, why does it matter? You only care about this because they're Pakistanis. It doesn't make any difference that they're brown instead of white. And I said, no, it does, because it's a racial divide. It's an ethnic insult as much as it's an assault on those individual girls. It's also a group violation, and as everyone would understand that perfectly well if the perpetrators were white. So, and I'm not going to go and imagine if the races were reversed, but it is true that everyone would. There'd be no mystery about why the race matters then. So,
right. Yeah. So perhaps you can see, coming from my interests in mass murder by states, right, where I was focused on a group being targeted, right. You know, like the kulaks being targeted by Stalin.
Yes.
In the Holodomor, as they now call it. And by the way, I wrote a poem about it and showed it to a survivor of that. And she said she put it up on her wall, which was probably the best moment of my life. But anyway, so, you know, I'm thinking about groups being victimized by states. I'm looking for these patterns where the state sort of disarms the victim group in various ways, makes them defenseless, and then either state functionaries themselves or even sometimes just other people are allowed to sort of be predators on the victim group, you know. So, you know, this is a pattern in my head, right? And then I get interested in, like, you know, why are these disarmed people so upset, you know? And I learn about the mass ethnic, you know, the so-called grooming gangs. And I'm like, oh, okay. You know, and so for me, I'm not coming at this necessarily as like, I'm a white guy, you know, it's more that I'm a scholar of mass murder by states, or mass victimization by states, if you will. And here's another case of it. And then, having said all that, the fact that, you know, say my own daughters could be subject to this kind of thing, well, it brings some personal angle to it, right?
Of course. And this is actually something that I think is missed by a lot of middle-class people in Britain. They think, well, this would never happen to my daughters because we don't live in an area, so I don't need to think about this, and I can even actively deny it, which is obviously a disgusting attitude.
Yeah, right. Right. And so why shouldn't I, just as I have written about, you know, and advocated for various victim groups who have been targets, why shouldn't I be an advocate for, you know, lower class white girls or whatever, you know, or Kyle Rittenhouse, right? Or, you know, whoever it is. For some reason, for some people, the fact that the victims are white means that it's okay, or you shouldn't talk about it or something. And that just goes right over my head. I just don't get that.
Well, it's, yeah, of course. And I suspect that 100 years ago, those same people would have had a completely different attitude. I think this is to do with the conditioning that specifically white people have been targeted with. Since then, you know, over the last 80 years or so, the end result being that the worst thing they could be is racist, but also caring about their their own race or even recognizing their own race is a racist thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
So right. You know, it's like an abusive partner psychologically conditioning his partner, his victim, so that she will just accept any abuse from him whatsoever. Mm-hmm. It's evil.
Yeah, and I don't accept it. So another personal angle to bring in here that connects to all this is that I've always been part of a radical fringe my whole life.
See, that's interesting because that's
the radical part of radical liberation, right?
Yes, I see. Because it's interesting because you come across as very, if you don't mind me saying so, well-balanced. You don't come across as the kind of person who tends to be into radical politics or fringe politics. You seem, I wouldn't say conventional exactly, but, you know, mm-hmm. not mad or anything.
Right. Well, I try not to be. I'm a lot less mad than I once was, that's for sure. a lot less insane than I once was. That's right. I for me, this is normal. So like I said, my father was a missionary to the Jews in a area that was very Jewish. I went to both a high school and a university that were 40% Jewish. I was passing out tracts when I was 8 years old on the street, you know, doing street activism, right?
Tracts?
Gospel.
Right. Okay.
Yeah. Reaching out to people with the gospel, right? And I was being persecuted in high school for talking to Jews about Jesus, you know. So for me, being on out of the mainstream is just normal, whether from the point of view of being part of this part of Christianity I was part of, which is, by the way, totally orthodox in its beliefs. It's just most Christians don't reach out to Jews, and we did. And that was considered edgy, you know, whether it's part of that or whether being a libertarian anarchist or, as I'm very tempted to change to on my Twitter profile, a medieval anarchist is probably better for these circles for people to understand what where I'm coming from. But anyway, or, you know, whether as an anarchist or now hanging out with dissident right folks, to me, being on a bit of the fringe, though not crazy, has been my whole life. In fact, when I was young, I was worried that I was part of like a cult or something for some reason. Maybe somebody teased me at school. I don't know. And so I went to my mom and I said, "Mom, are we fanatics?" And she said, I thought this was very useful. She said, "No, a fanatic is someone who has like the one thing and they can't talk about anything else. They're, you know, monomaniacal. Is the word I would use now. That's what she described. She said, "We're zealots. We're zealous for the gospel." And so right. I've always liked that. The fanatics are the ones who, as Frody has been talking about, kind of ruin it for all of us, right?
Yes.
Yeah. When he was saying, we just need some normal people, you know? anyway, so it's the fanatics who ruin it for the rest of us. But to be zealous for justice, right? Like in the case of this mass ethnic rape stuff, to be zealous for justice in that, I don't think there's anything wrong or weird or crazy about that. It's only the natural godly response to yes. something so horrifying.
Right? To be honest, I think that our opponents on the left are zealous, but also furthermore, the situation in the world today is so perverse that those who are not zealous, those who are in the center and milk toast, I think are rather mistaken. I think they're rather deluded. I think if you see the way the world is today, how could you not be zealous about something in some kind of new direction or even just the need for a radical new direction? As has been said about certain centrist YouTubers, their ideas are not radical. They're not nearly radical enough. They don't even recognize the scope and gravity of the problem.
Right.
So, you know, going back to 95 or 2005 is not enough. We need a deep rethinking of our society and the way we live.
Right. Radical means to the root, right?
Indeed.
Yeah. And that's more where I'm coming from. We've got big problems. Now, how is it that people don't see them? And how is it that I do? Well, one other thing to share about myself is that in high school, when I was, say, 15, I decided to stop reading the news. And I never went back. So I actually don't consume like CNN and NPR, which is sort of the equivalent of the BBC News in the UK, and haven't for, well, what would that be, 35 years now? As Jacques Ellul talks about in Propaganda, to keep people going with the current sort of line of the day, you have to be constantly peppering them with the propaganda. Yes. And if they unplug from that pop propaganda, it doesn't take too long for them to notice, wait a second, you were saying like the opposite just like a month ago, right?
Yes.
So you have to stay plugged in to be able to kind of keep believing whatever it is they're feeding us 5 minutes ago.
Right? Yeah, because the sheer volume of stuff that's coming in is too much for your mind to marshal, and therefore you can't detect the contradictions. Right. Obviously, we've seen this recently with COVID, where the numbers change by the day, the implications of those numbers change by the day. Yeah. It's just quite incredible. I think people are kept in a sort of hamster wheel. And of course, right. This is where the jokey cliche about the Amish comes in. Why aren't the Amish affected by COVID? Because they don't have TV. And yeah. I don't know if that's true or not, but we can certainly imagine how it could be true.
Right. Well, certainly they wouldn't have the climate of fear that is a constant push of the media. And not to get back into the philosopher cat thing, but you know, AA has been talking about that. And I would say this, that right now it's COVID and lockdown. I could see them changing to something else, because I've been watching this for decades now. I could see them changing to something else within a month or a year. But what would remain constant? Fear. That is the running theme that I see through the weapons of mass destruction campaign from the neocons, right, to get the invasion of Iraq, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Whatever it is, there is some bogeyman of the day. There is something you're supposed to be afraid of. And the media, the lackey media, as I like to call them, their function is to make sure that whatever it is you're supposed to be afraid of, they are hitting you with that 24/7 until you submit and you join in the fear camp. You know, you submit to the fear.
See, I think there are two versions of this that have gone on simultaneously with the war on terror, or the war against terror. I always forget that the acronym is TWAT. There was... First, there's the fear of Islam and, you know, fundamentalist Islam. But then there's also the fear of being racist as a result of fearing fundamentalist Islam. So they get you worried about fundamentalist Islam, but then also worried about being racist as a result.
Get you coming and going.
It's like kept on this constant... oscillation between one thing and the other, which is obviously quite dementing. With COVID, obviously that's this is the perfect thing for them to use as a vehicle for fear. This is one thing I wanted to say, that this is a cliche of, and I've said this on my own, and I know that you listen to the Graham broadcast that I do. In one of those, I pointed this out, that it's a cliche that governments rule and tyrants rule by fear. They rule by getting the populace to be afraid of something, an enemy that everyone can hate. But that's exactly what's happened now. In the most obvious...
Watch it play before you.
Yes, exactly. In the most obvious and crass way. They've got a population really very frightened. And people who believe in it all must have had a terrible 2 years. I mean, I don't know how many people there still are who really believe in it all.
Right.
But at this point, maybe that number is diminishing. But certainly throughout 2020, I think a large percentage of the British public were literally living in fear throughout that year.
Back on TV, or, you know, the media consumption issue, I just wanted to share something from Lou Rockwell, the founder of the Mises Institute. Someone came to him and was talking about how they're just, to use our lingo now, black-pilled, this is before anyone said that kind of thing, but you know, that's what they were expressing. You know, they were just so down, you know. And he said, "Do you watch TV?" I said, "Well, yeah." And he said, why don't you try stopping? And it was interesting. His reasoning for this is slightly different than why I stopped. I had my TV shot, by the way.
Shot with a gun?
Yeah, yeah. Well, I'm an American, Rose. I mean, you know, that's how we do things. Anyway, yeah, I kept it on display. It was one of those big old-style cabinet TVs, you know, like from the 50s or something. And I had it on display because it sort of had a nice webbing.
Yes.
So I had it on display at my apartment. This was before I got married, of course. There's no shot TVs with my wife around. But so his reasoning on the TV is, he said, you know, with such a big world with, you know, billions of people, there's always something bad going on, something crass going on. Well, what the TV seems to do is find those things and shove them in your face so that it feels like that is what life is, right?
Yes.
Or we might say these days, what life is, you know, being afraid. He was talking more about just, you know, crass behavior being shoved in your face all the time and things like this. And he said, you know, turn off the TV and talk to your neighbors and be in like real life. And you'll find that, you know, a lot of people are just living their life and they're not what gets depicted on the television. You know, I remember a friend from South India, Kerala, he came to the United States and he called back to his family and he said, there were two things that shocked him based on the perception of America he had from the media, I guess. He said, number one, people aren't shooting each other in the streets. number two, there's churches on every corner. And on Sunday, they're packed. You know, he had no idea that America was like a Christian, you know, had a bunch of Christians in it.
Yes. Yes. I can imagine. I think that, again, a lot of Europeans have this notion of America, that everyone's just walking around with a gun. Right. And, you know, any minor disagreement in a shop will result in a standoff. Obviously, that's ridiculous.
Right. Hey, quick shill for my channel. We did a show on the not so wild, wild west, because even the so-called wild west wasn't even like that. That is just a Hollywood invention. They lie about everything.
Well, and of course, that era of Hollywood, the Wild West genre, it was from a Hollywood that was much more sympathetic to white America than the Hollywood of, well, even the 90s, let alone the 2020s.
Right, right. I mean, back then, the Wild West was violent, depicted as violent, but it wasn't necessarily depicted as racist, right? Now they're going to add...
Or transphobic. well, yeah, I mean, there are obviously lots of questions that arise from your life story. One thing I would ask about 9/11 is, because you didn't say how you predicted it. You said you felt anger.
Yeah, it was. When I think back, it really was, and I'm amazed to say this because I was emotionally shut down most of my life until recently, but I was like being emotionally attuned is the term, you know, when you start to feel what other people are feeling, you know, that's what was effectively happening. I think back and that's really how I saw it coming, is I could just feel the anger rising. And I just felt like if I was feeling what they were feeling, I might really do something big.
Right. You
know? Right.
I've remembered what it was that I wanted to ask you. Sorry.
Yeah.
Because you did explain that. It was that, do you think America in the 90s had become, or by the end of the 90s, do you think it had become too arrogant a superpower?
Well, again, I go back to Americans just really being parochial, in a sense, if you can consider a country as big as the United States being parochial. Americans, I regularly use the term the U.S. empire. And part of the reason I use the term is because I think it's right. But the other reason is because I say it because I know there's some Americans, it's going to get them to think. Because we don't talk about the U.S. empire in within the U.S.
Yeah, and there's also
they literally don't know what the American government is up to outside the borders of the United States as a general thing.
Yeah, that there's a separation between, you know, the entity of the empire and the entity of the nation, which births that empire. I think it was the same in Britain. I mean, a lot of people, most ordinary people in Britain, would never experience the empire, you know, during the 19th century. They would obviously know of it, and including by name, unlike modern Americans, but it wouldn't be a part of their daily lives. It would be a fact of their existence, but not a part of their daily lives. The nation is one thing, the empire is another thing.
Yep. I wouldn't describe Americans as in denial about the empire, because that would imply that really deep down they know and they're just denying it. No,
yeah.
That's not what I was implying.
Wasn't trying to imply that. I think with America, you've got this situation where their interests aren't even part of the empire. They're part of the empire's activities. Whereas, you know, with Britain, you could say, well, it's, you know, helping us with trade, it's helping us with getting this resource, and we are exporting our culture to the rest of the world in some sense. We're also learning a great deal from the rest of the world and bringing that knowledge back to Britain. None of that really applies with America, does it?
Right. Justin Raimondo, passed now, unfortunately, from antiwar.com. He would always say, you know, the American empire, where everything goes out and nothing comes in. You know? In other words, I'm agreeing with you. You know, people don't feel like, wow, I'm so glad that the American empire is there because X, Y, Z. They wouldn't know how to finish that sentence because they just don't even think about it. And they wouldn't know what it would be doing for them except defending our freedoms, or you've got to fight them there, they'll be here, or, you know, vague slogans that if you ask them, what are you talking about? They wouldn't even be able to get past the slogan, you know?
Yes. It's something that they've heard. Of course, that thing about defending our freedom, and I remember George W. Bush saying that in the aftermath of 9/11, that they're attacking us because they hate our freedoms. And of course, that's ironic, because it was drivel anyway, but it's ironic to think of it now, 20 years later, because, well, we're not as free as we were then. You know, our freedoms have all been curtailed in those 20 years, such that I can imagine some, you know, camel riding tribesman in a cave in Afghanistan thinking of the modern Western citizen and thinking, why do they put up with that? Why do they put up with that life that they have over there with their, you know, their kid being raised with gay indoctrination at school? I mean, I can easily imagine them thinking that they are actually more free than us at this point. Now, I'm not saying this to just be sort of clever. I think there is an element of truth to that.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I'm going to have to stick it out because I haven't heard from the Lord very much. But one time I did very clearly is, you know, my church was a church that sent a lot of missionaries out and so forth all over the world. And so some missionary was giving a presentation. And so I prayed and I was like, God, is this, you know, being a missionary? I'm open to doing it if that's what I'm supposed to do. And he said no. And my feeling from that was not just that, like, it wasn't a feeling of like, oh, good, I don't have to be a missionary. It was more like, no, I'm calling you to stay in the U.S. and it might not be fun. And that was, you know, 40 years ago that I felt that. I think it makes more sense now, that feeling I had back then, that being called to stay here and not to leave might be a grim mission. It might not have made much sense to me at the time. I just felt it. But now it makes a lot more sense, right? If we keep going the way we're going, then staying in the U.S., you know, it's going to be a hard go.
Yes, indeed. And I think it's interesting because in late 2018, I think it was, I had a particular YouTuber on Millennial. I won't name who it was because I don't want to. Well, it doesn't really matter who it was. And he said, yes, we need to organize a protest around Parliament in Westminster in London. and put our demands to them. And I said to him, but what are our demands? And this is pre-COVID, pre-everything, pre-lockdown, all this. And I said, but what are our demands? And he didn't know. And I didn't know. we just knew that there was some cause for discontent, or there was something was emerging, or something was about to emerge. Our society had taken some kind of turning. There was an atmosphere of discontent, but it was not yet manifest. It was not yet directed. And then, of course, COVID came a year later, a year and a half later. And suddenly it makes sense why there was this atmosphere of discontent in 2018 and 19, which a lot of people didn't pick up on. I did pick up on it. Now, I did not predict COVID. I absolutely am not going to claim credit for that.
Yeah, none of us did.
No, none of us did. But there was a sense of a vacuum, like we were between eras. And I actually was planning. I remember one of those many videos that I planned during my hiatus and never made. One of them was called Between Two Paradigms. Mm. Or Between Paradigms. And it was about that. It was making this point that nothing seems to be happening. We seem to be at the eye of a storm and nothing is happening, but there is a sense of danger and impending. And another video that I planned was The Widening Gyre, which was a reference to the, I think it's Keats' poem. I can't remember who wrote it now. But there was that sense of things like anything could be about to happen.
That's now come
to pass. But the point I was making was, at the time, we didn't know why we felt this discontent, apart from all the usual complaints about the modern world, you know, LGBT, mass immigration, multiculturalism, feminism. But that wasn't quite the point. It was more a sense of a direct threat to liberty, a direct threat to the individual. Mm-hmm. But as I say, it hadn't manifest yet. So it was interesting. At that point, we didn't know what the complaint actually was. But now it's become much more obvious, right in your face, you know?
Yeah. And I don't necessarily have to believe that, you know, it was all a grand four-dimensional plan, right? But it does seem like a lot of things start to fall in place that you look back and you go, ah, okay. This is like a culmination of things that had been developing, right?
Yes. And it took us by surprise, but a very perceptive person could have perhaps predicted it. Yeah.
Right. Well, libertarians did in a way, but yeah. So I would say that working the medieval anarchist angle here, I really like where maybe not in the end stages, but part of what we're seeing a culmination of goes quite a ways back, which is that, you know, the era that I would look back to as Christendom, you know, as sort of the birthplace of the things that we celebrate about the West, you know, art and science and universities and all these things that, you know, before they were totally paused were amazing, right? There was a shift from the medieval situation, which was a lot of small polities, right? City-states, bishoprics. A favorite of mine is Salzburg, Austria. Love that place. It was a bishopric. It was a seat of a bishop, and basically that city was a little political entity, right? Mm-hmm. And there are places like this all over Europe. You see maps from back then. They're just little quilts, patchwork quilts, right?
Yes.
But over the last several hundred years, there was just more and more consolidation. With localities being crushed in favor of a more and more centralized organization, right? For some reason, the Bretons are on my mind. I know why. Someone was sharing a song from the Bretons praising the coming of an English lord to help them fight against the French, you know? You know, there were all these peoples, ethnic groups, I guess we could say, right? European ethnicities. That had identity, that had their own language in many cases. And they all started to get ground down over the last several hundred years in favor of more uniform identities that were going across larger and larger geographic areas, right?
Yes, amalgamation.
Consolidation, centralization, whatever you want to call it, right? but the trend is away from the local, away from a smaller, more humble, more human community, to something that is more abstract, harder to get your hand around, right?
Oh yeah.
Harder to feel like you're participating in any meaningful way. You know, like, what do I have to do with what the U.S. government does? Even as a politically interested person, I just feel like a dot compared to what's going on with the U.S. government, right? I don't feel I have any sway over the fate of my community, right?
Yes, and this cannot be a healthy situation.
Doesn't seem right.
For intelligent men to feel that they have no agency, no influence right. on their own society, that I can understand, you know, this might sound bad. I can understand an unintelligent part, like a dumpling, not having influence. Fine, I don't want the village idiot having a vote. But when when decent and intelligent and sensible men feel that they even are just meaningless subjects of globalist powers right. that they cannot see, that they cannot negotiate with, that they cannot even comprehend. That must be a deeply unhealthy situation, and one that is bound to create all sorts of dysfunction.
Right, right. And we for a while there, it seemed like the nation state was sort of a terminus, right? Well, sure, you know, all these local identities were crushed in favor of France or the United States or the United Kingdom or whatever, but then it stops, right? Well, as Morgoth has been pointing out lately, it's not stopping, because now government, you know, like national government, is being replaced with governance, international NGO style
yes.
governance, right?
Yes. My previous guest, Mark Malone, went into yes. this distinction right. at some length. Yeah, it was very good stuff. And of course, right. Morgoth's own video, I think probably the best video he's done this year, was about the whale and the, oh God, I can't remember the
elephant and the whale.
Yes, that's it, the elephant in the well.
Right.
That was a very good characterization of the dynamics of power.
Right. So you see why I'm bringing it up, because I'm talking about an arc that's been going on for several hundred years.
Exactly.
And I'm saying that it's continuing. We're watching before our eyes it go into another stage, where it seemed to stabilize at the nation state in, say, the 20th century. Because remember, Italy and Germany, for example, were not even consolidated until the 19th century. That's really quite recent, right?
Yeah, I think it was 1870 for Germany. I can't remember.
Right, exactly. So you know, we just had about 100 years or so of the nation state being like a somewhat stable point, and we're already going to the next stage now, which is this web of international governance where you just have no idea who's in charge anymore, right? It's really murky. I mean, maybe it's Klaus Schwab. I don't know. But it's like people like him or something.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. 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 I would imagine it is people like him. That's another issue altogether. Either way, it's people who would never listen to you and me. It's people, you know, that they wouldn't watch our YouTube channels. I mean, that they wouldn't take us seriously as people. It's individuals who are operating at a very different level. And you know, I'm fine with the concept of people, you know, at a high level in society who are observing society from a different height. Fine. But that has to be moderated with sanity. And I don't think that Klaus Schwab's thinking is.
Yeah. So something you'll see if you follow me on Twitter is that I regularly talk about the insane center. The insane mainstream, and I'm playing off of Mills. I'm forgetting the scholar. Anyway, he talked about crackpot realism. C. Wright Mills, that's it. Crackpot realism, right. And Murray Rothbard brought this up in regards to the Cold Warriors, who would game out, you know, how we could win a nuclear war with Russia, which was famously lampooned in Dr. Strangelove, right? What he was lampooning there was absolutely real. I've met one of these people, and they're just insane. But they sound very scholarly, and you know, they're like, like you said, thinking on a high level. You know, the world is like this chessboard, you know?
Yes.
But they're nuts.
Yeah, like, because the world might be a chessboard to them, but each of the pieces is meaningless. It's a mathematical factor.
Yes. Yeah, they don't... It feels inhuman the way they relate to the rest of the world. They see us as pawns to be played with, as opposed to fellow men, you know, fellow persons.
Yes.
Right.
Yes. Exactly. I think this is one of the prerequisites for a healthy society, that the elite have to have some kind of connection. They have to feel, even if they don't have a real connection, they have to feel a connection with the rest of the citizenry. Because otherwise you end up with this exact situation that we have now, where, you know, I don't believe that Bill Gates gives a toss about me or my culture or my city or my my people, anything whatsoever about me. Why should I trust him?
Right. Yeah, I mean, on a simple scale, you know, someone loses their small business because of the lockdown, right? They don't have customers because customers aren't allowed to come to their place of business, and they lose their small business, and it's what they'd poured their money and their time into building, you know?
Their life. It could be their life's work. And
we ever felt compassion from, you know, the Faucis and the...
Indeed.
You know, et cetera, about these sorts of things? I don't think so.
Especially galling, because I think that this has all happened unnecessarily. I think that the whole COVID thing, it didn't need to go into lockdown. So those small businesses, family businesses, inherited family businesses going back generations in many cases, didn't need to shut down. We have lost all of these things, these fruits of human labor, without any good reason. It did not need to happen. I mean, I know businesses, I've seen, but like in my own hometown, in my home city, in the city where I live now, that disappeared, and they'll never come back. You know, that's it. But meantime, Amazon have got richer, and all these other tech companies have got wealthier. So there's this awful sense that it all happened for without good reason, but also, as you say, this sense that the people responsible don't even feel guilty. I mean, they feel nothing. It's Bill Gates seems to be having a whale of a time. all of them, whale, no pun intended. And also the politicians, and this is another part of it. People like Justin Trudeau, that awful Jacinda Ardern, or I can never remember.
Yeah, I know what you mean. New Zealand.
Yes, and the awful politicians in Australia, Joe Biden, Kamala Harris, these horrendous people. Again, in Germany and Sweden, all of them, they seem to despise the publics to whom they communicate on the TV and in their speeches. There doesn't seem to be any actual genuine concern. I mean, when they're saying we have to do this because of this threat, they don't actually seem concerned. This is one of the reasons why it's a bit of a, I won't use an impolite word, but it's a bit of a confusing thing that they're saying this while not even sounding concerned. You know, you'd think if it were a real pandemic and a real emergency, they would sound scared, and yet they don't.
Right. They party while they're supposedly so afraid.
Exactly. And you can't
bit
help
of a
thinking
giveaway.
Of, yeah, exactly. And you can't help thinking of the communist, the cliche that the Bolsheviks were having banquets while the peasants were starving and, you know, just dying out from starvation. The Politburo and so on, the high up commissars were just having a great time. You know, it's this sort of brazen corruption.
It makes me think of that moment from the 2016 election. I remember my wife was really struck by it when Hillary Clinton did the basket of deplorables line, right?
Yes.
And my wife said, "It's over." She said that she's going to lose. I mean, you can't just call the voters deplorables and win an election, you know? But anyway, you know, I hadn't thought about it till now. I always thought about that as revealing about Hillary Clinton, but I think she was really revealing about her whole sort of set.
Yes. You know,
her whole class. It was, Obama had a similar thing. You know, what do you say with their guns and their Bible? Those ignorant people with their guns and their Bibles, or something like that. You know, they, you know, which describes, by the way, like all the Christians I know in the country. You know, and I know a lot of them. So you know, I mean, they're expressing contempt not for some narrow niche fringe radical group. They're expressing contempt for basically the people of their country.
And certainly the backbone of their country, the people who do the boring jobs that no one hears about because they're not glamorous. This is what I was saying earlier, that the elite, a healthy society requires an elite that have some kind of connection or feel a connection, a warmth towards the common folk, because otherwise you're going to have this kind of thing. You're going to have them decreeing that you cannot see Grant, like your 5-year-old daughter can't see her granny at Christmas, and there's no one to complain to there, and if you don't like it, tough. You're selfish and evil, actually, for complaining about it. I don't want to Fed post on my own channel.
Exactly. That'd be ridiculous. So you know, F.A. Hayek wrote The Road to Serfdom, right? There's a chapter of it that I recommend to everyone. Chapter 10, it's called Why the Worst Get on Top. And he describes why in a social democratic system like we all live under now, you're not going to get the honest people in positions of powerful political leadership. You're going to get people who are liars and corrupt. And he explains exactly why. It's really worth reading. Even having read that all that time ago, I don't know that I was prepared for what I see, for example, with Vice President Kamala Harris. I think she's a psychopath. I mean, she's not
another psychopath.
She's not just a person who's a little bit corrupt or something. Like, she's not normal. Like, she tries to be normal. And it gives you that uncanny valley experience.
That's the feeling I have with Hillary Clinton.
Yeah, it's like, stop smiling, please. You're creeping me out, you know?
Yes, exactly. Yeah, yeah. The crazy eyes as well. And that over-friendliness. You see this with Kamala, for sure, but you see it with a lot of them. I mean, Jacinda Ardern. But yes, I know what you mean. I think there are undoubtedly democracy seems to make this very possible. I suspect, and of course, sociopaths, psychopaths are always going to be attracted to power centers. That makes sense.
Absolutely.
But I suspect that in a monarchy or an aristocracy, it's much harder for them to get a foothold. And there will, because, well, I don't really need to go into that. It's a tangent. I think that democracy just gives them 1,000 avenues by which to, well, lie,
right,
and to curry favor and to gain undue power.
I'm assuming you're doing this so that you can segue so beautifully into another shill for my channel. So a recent series we did was on democracy versus monarchy.
Oh.
And we drew on Eric von Kanot-Ledin and Hans Hermann Hoppe, who famously criticized democracy, right? I actually had the pleasure of meeting Kanot-Ledin right near the end of his life, which was amazing. It was like getting a little taste of the 19th century or something, 19th century, century Austria. I could feel that, how do I put it nicely? We're all lesser men than he was. he came from a civilization that's been destroyed, you know. But anyway, and in this series, we very carefully go through his critique of democracy, first of all. And then he says, well, okay, you could say that all this stuff is true of democracy. Let's say you agree with me so far. But you could still say it's the worst system except for all the others or some crap like that, right? And he says, so let's compare it to some other system. And how about one that we have a lot of experience with? And so he talks about monarchy. because, of course, we had monarchy in Christendom for hundreds and hundreds of years. So we have plenty of track record to look at. And yes, indeed, like Hoppe, Hoppe was influenced by him. He concludes that monarchy is a superior system to democracy. Worth noting that I, like Hoppe, like Knut Ledeen, we're all anarchists. So we don't think monarchy is the best system of all possible systems, just better than democracy. At least you have, for example, going to the psychopathic aspect, you have the personal responsibility, right? If the king's screwing you over, that jerk is the one screwing you over, right? Whereas now, especially as we go from government to governance, right, you just have this sense that like the amorphous blob is screwing you over and you're not exactly even sure who to blame for it.
Well, you've got no idea who to blame for it.
Yeah, yeah.
None. And I use the analogy of, and I know that I have this reputation for being obsessed with my own Twitter ban. I'm not anymore. It was 3 years ago. I'm very much over it. Don't worry.
You're on stage 7 of the stages of grief. Right?
Yeah. Maybe 5.5. But, okay. Yeah, I am over it. It's just that this particular analogy, I think, is useful. And it was that when I appealed to Twitter, the email that I got back was signed Twitter. It wasn't signed with the name of an individual employee. And I see that as a portent of how this will... how governance will be, where you're just up against the machine and you've got no idea what goes on behind the curtain, none whatsoever. Just like we've got no idea how YouTube, what the hell goes on at YouTube? Like, who makes the decisions? By what protocols do they make decisions? Right. Who was responsible for what? No one, you and I will never know that. It's impossible to track. And indeed, I wouldn't be surprised if they just delete the evidence of decision-making processes after it's done so that no one will ever know.
Right.
So it's all quite Kafka-esque.
I was going to say, so Kafka ends up being the dystopian author that got it right. Yeah.
Well, it's the old Venn diagram with Brave New World, 1984, Soylent Green.
Kafka, yeah. But that sense of bad things are happening to me, bad things are happening to my community, bad things are happening to my children, and I don't even know where to start to do something about it, right?
Yeah. I think that's perhaps what we're here to try to identify.
Yeah, so let me turn from the negative to the positive and just talk about what we've done.
Didn't mean within the scope of this particular stream. I just mean that what we do in general is that we're obviously identifying the problems, but hopefully beyond that, we're also going to identify a way forward. But anyway,
I just thought I'd make some comments, personal comments, and it's nothing that I can. I'm not the sort to say I've done it this way, and so everybody else should. I just thought it can't hurt to just describe a little bit of what we've done. And not only because it hopefully is interesting, but also because we try to provide resources on my channel to support it. And we're going to be providing more. So my wife is a trained therapist, a marriage and family therapist. She was in private practice until 2 weeks before our first child was born. And then she stopped to be home with the children and homeschooled them. And so she's given birth, in some cases, home births to all these babies and is schooling them and has been schooling them all this time. Because in our case, we had so many children, we ended up moving to a property with 4.5 acres where we have chickens and ducks and quail and goats and a pony on the way any day now. So we are able to create a little island of our own here and where we're not worried about, say, school shootings. I'm just amazed everybody still sends their kids to government schools after all these school shootings. But anyway, do what you got to do. But we're not subject to the latest round of propaganda that they're giving the kids. I've even heard, I think this was in the U.S., right, where they were saying, hey, if you let us vaccinate you, then we'll give you pizza or something, like going around the parents' back and vaccinating children, right?
Yeah, it's unbelievable. It's the kind of thing that in a sane society, you know, somebody would be in prison for a very long time for that.
Yeah, exactly, right. Just amazing. And so, you know, my wife and I were in agreement of, you know, independently had made this conclusion before we got married that we would want to homeschool our children if we had any. So I think that helps us unplug a bit. We don't do broadcast television. We do have, what do you call it, cable cutter type solutions where you can, you know, dial up a movie you want to watch and watch it. But we don't have just a TV channel going, right?
Oh, thank God. It's funny whenever I should be careful because maybe some of my viewers do that. But whenever I'm in someone's house and they have just the TV's just on, you know, it's awful because you can't not look at the TV. It's like there's this hypnotic. It's sort of it draws your eyes to it. You can't get away. It's awful, and of course, it's just blaring drivel into the room
and propaganda. Right.
Yeah, oh yeah, that as well.
Right. Yeah. So we put a great emphasis. Part of the reason we moved, besides having 10 of us in 1,100 square feet, is that we're really concerned that there was space for people to get away from such a big family and go off in a corner and read, or, you know, we have two daughters who have an art studio here. This is part of the downside of you not being on Twitter. I bet you'd love my daughter's paintings. But anyway, you know, so we were really concerned about, we're both introverts, maybe that's part of the reason why, but very concerned about there being space for our children to develop their interests and their personality. So anyway, that's sort of, I guess, our response to some of the things we've been discussing. And it's just at the family level, right? We haven't formed a compound with other families or anything like that, as the government would call it when they destroy it. You know, I feel like it's been a bit, these choices have been beneficial. And it's very interesting for us. My wife and I both went to government school. It's very interesting for us to tell stories from our time at school to our children, or for them to get stories from their friends who are in a government school and to see their reactions, which basically are normal human reactions if you didn't just grow up thinking that this was insanity was normal, right?
Yes.
They're just like, what? What happened? You put up with that? You know, they just can't believe it. It just seems crazy to them. Mm. What to us was just our childhood, our normal childhood. You know?
Yeah.
Normal.
I mean, when I look back on school, especially at the end, I absolutely hated it. And I really just didn't belong. It was completely unnatural for me to still be at school from the age of 15 onwards. I desperately needed to get out of it. Well, actually, earlier than that, really. But anyway, it doesn't matter. When I look back on it, it just seems such an artificial and stifling environment, and artificially stifling as well. Even within the context of the school, it could have been less stifling than it was.
So
absurd.
Right. So in terms of providing resources for those who want to follow some of these paths, my wife and I have done two streams on homeschooling. And there is some talk, sort of philosophical kind of talk about, like, why did she decide to homeschool and everything. But it's also very nuts and bolts. You know, it really talks about how do you homeschool? And it addresses people's concerns about socialization and all that kind of stuff that people who are thinking about it need to have those questions answered, right? And so we try to answer them as best we can. We're actually planning on a part three, because so many people have been going to homeschooling, at least in the US. I don't know if that's happening in the UK. But it's been a heavy trend.
Put it this way, I think that the last 2 years with all that's been going on, I think that will have driven a lot of people, parents, towards thinking that. Could they do homeschooling?
Right.
Because obviously society in general is becoming so cold and formalized you know, for a lot. I mean, the wearing the masks, you know, little children having to do that and social distance from each other. It's just, it's so perverse.
Yeah, right. The big selling point they had left, supposedly, was that, you know, you'll get socialization if you go to the school. Well, now you're like, I've seen the pictures of the lunchroom where they're 12 feet away from each other, or whatever, you know, it's like, I'm not sure you're even getting socialization anymore, at least not anything we recognize as socialization.
No, there have been quite a few good memes based around that. You know, when there's some children wearing the mask, sitting 12 feet away from each other, and you know, the disinfecting thing is right there. And it's like, oh my God, what kind of notion of other people and your relationship to other people are you going to develop in that environment? It seems almost tailor-made to make people, well, you know, to make them develop hang-ups.
So the reason my mind jumped to our streams is because that's one of the things we emphasize there, is that we feel like you don't have to teach children to be curious about the world. They are curious about the world. They're born curious about the world. Anyone who's been around a small child sees that, right? They're looking at the world with wonder and awe. It's the schooling, in our experience, like the government schooling, that drives the curiosity out of kids and makes learning seem like, I don't know, something geeks do, you know?
Yeah.
Right? As opposed to something that is your own passion. And, you know, that you start to develop an interest and you want to understand certain aspects of the world. You want to answer certain questions. And so you start digging into it for yourself, you know. That's, you know, I just happen, for whatever reason, probably because of my family, right? I just happen to be that way despite being in government school. And I would literally have a book I was reading hidden inside my textbook. I'd hold my textbook up. And I'd have another book inside it that I would be reading during class because I was so thirsty to learn.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. But it's lovely that survived, that it wasn't you know, crushed.
Right. But you've seen it, right? How the curiosity gets driven out.
Oh, yes.
In that system.
It happened to me as well. I could tell anecdotes about that. But I think people understand. So I think that the homeschooling, I think it's a very good idea, very helpful, because for you to be doing that, because I think people value an example to follow or an example to be inspired by far more than people just telling them to do this, sort of imploring them to do it.
Exactly. I was on another stream recently and somebody responded to it and said, and we didn't even talk about homeschooling, I don't think. But he said, I pulled my children out of the school because of watching this stream. And so I wrote back to him. It was on Twitter. And so I replied to him and I said, you know, here we have some streams on homeschooling. And then I told my wife and she asked me to offer to him that if he had any questions, she would answer them. You know, so
we're
not just you know, doing a quick video on it. We really intend to be a resource where we can and help people.
That's great. About the, because you said that you've got this, your house, and it's not a big society sort of project. It's just the scope of your own life, your own family. But I think that is honestly a very admirable goal to have, because, you know, historically the idea, especially for a man, of having his own house and having his own home where his family are safe and secure and where things are as he wants them to be, his environment is tailored for him and his loved ones. That is a very laudable goal. And I think that it's part of, you know, and yet another aspect of the sickness of the modern world is that people no longer think of their homes in that sense. They think of them as an investment, temporary thing, and then I'll move somewhere else. And if it's the, you know, modern homes in a city, then there's very little in the way of customization that you can do. So it's more like a cell than a home. I think that, and for me personally, you know, recently I find myself really thinking about how much I would love to just live in a cottage in the countryside where I wouldn't have to think about the rest of the world. And that would be lovely. Actually, that reminds me, I should really shill for donations far more often than I'm doing.
Yeah, yeah.
I'll never get that cottage if I don't shill for donations.
Support woes.
So if people, because I only did it once at the start in the first stream. If people would like to donate and support me and, you know, help me get a bit further to that, closer to that cottage, then there are multiple ways you can do that at millennialwoes.com/donate, millennialwoes.com/crypto. And also there is a Bitcoin Lightning address. But on the donation page, there are many different avenues by which you can support me. So if you value my work and Millennial itself, then please do that. That would be very much appreciated.
So on the home thing, I came by this the hard way, you might say. And I'm going to say something that's negative about my parents, but who are both passed now, but they said it about themselves, so I'm not saying anything inappropriate. My parents were really devoted to Christian ministry. I grew up with Bible studies and discussions going on in my home till 2 a.m, and I'm in my bedroom keeping the door open so I can keep listening, you know, because they're talking about like interesting stuff, you know. It's sort of a rather intellectual environment, I guess you could say. But, you know, later they really saw that they had not had a good enough boundary around the family and around the home. And right. I think that's what you were speaking to. And I think that's something my wife and I both feel strongly about. We do want to help people. We do want to minister to others where we can and help others. But it would be inappropriate for that to come at the cost of our marriage, our children, the safety and sanctity of our home and our land, right?
Yeah, of course.
So you know, finding that balance, I think, for me has been an important personal journey. The balance between, you know, wanting to be helpful. I mean, I grew up in a ministry family, so it's just in my bones to be that way, right? And there's nothing wrong with that, but that has to be balanced with taking care of your own. And the Bible talks about that. You know, Paul says, if you don't take care of your family, then you're worse than a heathen or whatever, you know.
A politician.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
You're worse than a journalist.
Yeah. Yeah, right. Back then it's Jesus hangs out with the prostitutes and the tax collectors, right? Now it's, you know, Jesus hangs out with journalists, you know. Ooh. What's up? What's going on with him there? You know?
Well, I mean, I get the feeling that we could talk for hours and hours, and I knew it would be like this. I was sure that when you and I, because this is the first time we've ever spoken, and I was sure that when I do finally speak to Radlib, it will be a very easy and enjoyable conversation with all sorts of tangents that we could go on. So I hope that we speak again.
Yeah,
soon. But I think, I nearly forgot to do the questions. I think we should probably wrap it up at that point. I'm paranoid that my computer is going to crash again or that the internet is going to cut out again. So I want to not tempt fate by going on too long. Here's one person. I think this was posted quite a long time ago. And it was when you were talking about that you've got 8 children, and he says, Radlib is the hero who shall personally lead the repopulation of the West. you have a fan there. And another person asks, Hominid, he asks, Radlib, what do you see in store for the US by the end of this century? Do you think it will even still exist? That's a big question.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm a big secessionist, as you can imagine from everything I've said, right? I would love it if we could reverse the homogenization process and go back. And I'm not picky. It doesn't have to be de jure. It can be de facto, right? Like, let it still be called the United States while in on-the-ground reality, towns, communities, cities are kind of doing their own thing, right? And just sort of being ignored by the central government while they do their own thing. That would be great. I personally don't want another war between the states. don't need the eternal Yankee to do their thing again. you know, I don't look forward to some kind of big conflict. I hope it doesn't come. I hope, like I said, I hope my hope, and I don't think it's a completely unrealistic hope. My hope is that, as we're already seeing, localities start to go their own way, just as happened with, as has been happening with the legalization of marijuana, as has been happening with vaccine mandates more recently, as you know, woes, right? Like Florida just hasn't been doing the same thing as other states.
Yes.
So very to good. Me, this is all to the good. Don't stop at the state level. Bring it down to the community, the locality. Let everybody go their own way and see how things work out. Learn from each other. And don't be upset that other people are doing things differently. That's my beautiful vision for my country.
Yeah, it is. Another example of that would be the Texas abortion debacle from a few months ago. I think that liberals, progressives were outraged at that, at the idea of our state doing something that was not in accordance with, you know, the doctrine of Kamala Harris.
Right.
They just couldn't believe that this would happen.
Yeah.
Okay, there's one other question. Would the black communities from St. Louis ghettos be better off in a black secessionist state? And I'm guessing you would say that they would be.
Yeah, that's interesting. You know, just recently, I've at the gym, I've been chatting with an older gentleman who's Nation of Islam. This is so-called black Muslims, like Malcolm X type stuff. You might be familiar with.
Yes, I am familiar with that. Yes.
Yeah. And it's really interesting about them. Like Marcus Garvey was in talks with the KKK at one point, you know. In other words, you would think that these, you know, would be people, you know, like blacks who hate whites and whites who hate blacks, when actually they were finding common ground because they're like, you want to have your community and I want to have mine. Great, let's do it, you know. So anyway, I would say that, okay, well, again, chilling for my show, we did a series on the history of Black Americans. And one of the parts that might surprise people the most is the middle. We did the bit on slavery. We did the bit on the disaster that's happened since, say, the Civil Rights era, roughly, and Great Society programs and all that. It's the middle part that no one knows about. What happened in the 100 years between the end of slavery in the United States and Martin Luther King and the Civil Rights Movement? Like, no one really knows what was happening with Black Americans. They were just, I don't know, being lynched or something, right? But that's not true at all. In fact, they were making great progress and they were building their own communities. And my Nation of Islam friend, that is actually his area of interest, is learning more about those Black communities and trying to bring them back, old Black towns and stuff like that. And he agrees with me that the era since the Civil Rights era has been destructive to the Black family, to Black communities.
Yes. It clearly has been. It's something that was talked about as a emancipation of an improvement for the Black American has just been devastating.
Right. I got to get my favorite phrase in, was stalking horse. Okay, I learned this from Reginald Demeril. Blacks and now LGBT, et cetera, right? They're the stalking horse for some other agenda, right? A stalking horse in hunting is where, right, you hide behind the horse, right, so that the deer can't see you or whatever. So what's behind the stalking horse? Well, it seems to be becoming more and more blatant, some kind of powerful cabal or something. I don't know, globalist cabal. What they use as a stalking horse, though, will get our anger directed at that stalking horse. But I've noticed that the stalking horse doesn't tend to come out very well after all said and done, right? Black Americans benefited from being the, you know, the cause celebre of the American Social Democrats for a couple decades? I don't think so. I think, you know, their families are falling apart, and it's a bad situation for American blacks because of those interventions, you know, supposedly for their own good.
Well, absolutely. And a similar thing has happened in Britain as well. Welfare that was supposed to save the white working class post-industrial decline has actually devastated them and created, you know, dead-end towns where there's drugs and violence and gangs.
This is the stuff Theodore Dalrymple writes about.
Absolutely. I was a huge fan of his 10 years ago. When I started the channel, I did quite a lot of readings of his essays back in the day. And I mean, I think it's more complicated than, you know, I personally think it's more complicated than he admits. I think that it's would be outside the scope of this, but I think in a post-industrial society, you shouldn't be surprised that the less intelligent don't have much to do, and so I think it's that this is where one of my gripes with libertarians is that they seem to have a sort of autism about this, where they think, well, the less intelligent should just move to another town or learn a new trade, learn a new skill. It's really not that simple, especially within the British context. But I think because of the class system, which frankly is quite oppressive, but also I think the human stock that we're talking about has less agency than the American equivalent. It's a complicated situation, but I do think that welfare in the way that it has been administered has been disastrous. Now, that's not to say that it would always be like that. I think that given, as I say, the way that society is going, there probably is going to need to be a welfare system of some kind. But giving people money for nothing and just to stay at home and despair and vegetate and whatever, it's obviously not going to turn out well. You're going to end up with generations of very degraded people.
Well, and we have to be thinking long term. I mean, that's how our forefathers were, right?
Yes.
They were thinking about building, building in terms of their family, building in terms of their community, building in terms of their buildings, right? Building for the long haul.
Indeed.
And these things that are easy, like living on the dole, easy in the short term, is that really going to get you in the direction of where you want your children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren to be, right? Where you want your community to be. So I think that's an acid test for a lot of this stuff. But where does it point us in the long term?
And also at the societal level, that this is where we were talking about with sociopaths and democracy versus monarchy and aristocracy. They always think far more long term than democracy, the politicians are thinking about the next 5 years and what, you know, bullshit schemes they can come up with to buy the votes of a gullible electorate for this next upcoming election. Who cares about the long term? Again, it's another argument in favor of some other.
Well, this is one of Hoppe's biggest arguments, right? Time preference argument, to use the jargon, that the politician is thinking about the next election, and the monarch, or maybe even better, the royal family, has this sort of longer term view that they don't want to screw up the deal for their family. You know,
exactly. Right? So I think that a society with a more longer term view would implement a welfare system that was less likely to just degrade its recipients in the long term.
Oh, and we had it. I mean, there's a book on this from Mutual Aid to the Welfare State by David Beto, and he explains how in the 19th century, and I'm sure this was true in Britain as well. 19th century and before, there were, you know, fraternal organizations. Sometimes it was, you know, people who worked in your same industry. Sometimes it was a religious, even an ethnic organization, right? Fellow Catholics or fellow Blacks. You would back each other up in times of trouble, right? But the nature of these organizations was that they didn't really want people who were just going to live off of them, right? You were supporting each other, but you were accountable to each other as well. So, you know, that got destroyed by the welfare state in the late 19th and then going into the 20th century. But there's nothing wrong with that model, and we can just quietly go back to it on our own.
Yeah, I mean, my question about that is, I can imagine it paying for the healthcare of the 19th century, but would it pay for, you know, the kind of, well, you know,
inflated,
complex, yeah. Much more sophisticated healthcare of today. But yeah, that's another thing altogether. Obviously, another huge debate that could be had and should be had, and I've no doubt will be had at some point. Okay, well, let's end it there. I don't think there are any other questions. Let me just do one last check. No, that seems to be it. Okay, so, well, this has been great. So thank you very much, Radlib, of Radical Liberation. People can find your, the link will be there to your channel.
Yeah, I should mention there's a YouTube channel. I am also on Telegram, Twitter I've been mentioning, but I'm also on Telegram. I haven't been doing as much with it except for announcing my show, which could be useful. But I'm kind of thinking I should start doing more with it because of the way things are going on Twitter. So I'm going to start trying to pay more attention to my Telegram channel.
Yeah. Philosophicat was saying the same thing to me. Exactly the same thing to me just yesterday. So, yeah, I think that everyone should. I mean, Telegram really is. I love it. And, I don't want to speak too soon. I might get banned from it tomorrow.
Right. They keep chasing us from one thing to another. Yeah.
Today, at least, I love it. So I would recommend that people get on there. I hope you do pursue that. I think it would be helpful. So, okay. Well, thank you very much for appearing on Millennial 2021.
All right. Merry Christmas, everyone.
Okay. And I'll be back tomorrow night. Hopefully, the reason I haven't had my webcam on in this stream is, you know, my internet seems to be unreliable tonight. So that's the only reason. I'll be back tomorrow night with another four streams, starting with Ed Dutton, the Jolly Heretic, then Hildebrand Szilard. And he is from the Edgelord Investor, which is a Telegram channel, and then Jim Goad, and then Chris Dangerfield. So that should be a very mixed, a very varied set there. So, okay, I will see you then, and hopefully you'll see me as well. And thank you for tuning in. Again, thank you, Radlib. And I'll see you all later on. Bye-bye for now.
Millennial Woes has created many things, and this is your chance to own one of them. A unique piece of work handcrafted by the Vile Vlogger to commemorate Millennial 2021. 100 hours of highly skilled labor went into producing this animated vector graphic, which can be magnified to any size. In the iconic Millennial Woes font, it glistens and responds to your touch. And at the center of it all, a figure representative of 2021, the White Stag, symbolizing endurance, discovery, and rejuvenation. This one-of-a-kind creation is up for sale as an NFT. Follow the link below, and it can be yours forever. This is your only chance.